So, Ava, where and how did you first start gardening?
Well, I actually started gardening in Ohio, where I was born and raised, as an organic farmer. Well, I wasn't born and raised as an organic farmer, but that was my entry into the gardening world during my college years. I've thought it's so cool listening to all of the speakers in this series. So many of them have gotten their start through their grandparents. And while my grandparents, one set of them anyway, did garden, they never really taught me, or it wasn't an activity that we did. And so I kind of came to it of my own devices through environmental ethics and sustainability interests. And I went on to be an organic farmer for 3 or 4 years after that. Yeah, and then I guess I'll add too, because I think it's worth mentioning, I went from there into doing field botany, which botany was my focus in college. And so I have had a love for plants forever, since college anyway, and got to know the plants in their native setting and realized that there are so many amazing, gorgeous ones that thrive on the natural conditions they have in nature. And so I was able to bring that education with me into the gardening world when I took my next step, which you kind of summed up, into the ornamental gardening world in around 2001.
So you've been doing this work professionally for over 10 years then?
I have, yeah. What I usually tell people is I've been working with plants for about 20 years, and I've been working within ornamental horticulture for about 10, yeah.
Okay. And tell me, what's the difference between field botany and botany? I've never heard that distinction before.
Well, just botany can mean a lot of things. It can be microscopic. You know, you're in a lab looking at DNA of plants and all genetics and stuff. And so I like to say that I did macrobotany.
Okay. I get it. All right, great. So where you are now, tell us your elevation and what your native soil is like.
Here in my garden in Durango, I'm at 6,800 feet, and my soil is a mixture of clay and sand, with the emphasis being on the clay. So little to no organic matter here.
And I've seen pictures of your place, and I know that you have crafted a spectacular garden despite clay and sand. So that's fantastic. So how were you introduced to the methods that you now use and teach?
Well, I started working at a nursery when I got to town because I moved from California, very different climate, and I wanted to learn all the ropes of how to do it here. So I thought that would be a good way to do it. I have a friend who calls working at a nursery horticultural boot camp because people are asking you questions all day long and you have to learn fast on your feet. So
yeah.
I did do that my first year, and so I got pretty familiar with the line the nursery's toe, at least that one in particular. But I think it's not very different than a lot of them. And a lot about using amendments and fertilizing and weed mat. And, of course, they're selling those products, so they have a good reason to want to recommend them. But soon after that, or around the same time, I got acquainted with Panayoti Kalaidis, who was a speaker early on in this series, and learned that there's another way. And then Panayoti actually recommended Bob Nold's book, High and Dry, and I just fell in love with what he had to say. He was also a speaker earlier. And so it was really through those guys, and then acquaintance with a lot of the other speakers through this series, that I realize there is another way that's easier, that doesn't involve so many products and purchases and schlepping resources around, not just from the nursery to your home, but I mean, those things come on trucks from all over the country and sometimes beyond, and that just doesn't feel right to me with my environmental mm-hmm. ethics I mentioned that I still have with me.
Excellent. So can you share, and I know that you've asked all your speakers this, and this sounds like a very interesting question to me. Can you share with us an aha moment that you had on your way to the understanding that you have today about gardening?
I can. The one that stands out to me most, I think, was actually while I was reading High and Dry, Bob Nold's book, the introduction to it. And at one point he says, I think even the introduction or something is headed with, if the pilgrims had landed at La Jolla. And he talks about if the people who settled this country had, you know, in the Western way that it is now and all that, had landed in California instead of on the East Coast, that we would be growing plants that are more adapted to our pedicale soils, like has been talked about throughout the series, and with very little rainfall. And it wouldn't be so much this eastern palette of plants that comes from England and thrives in New England. And so that whole concept, along with realizing that there is very, without the forests of the east, there's way less leaf litter on the surface of our soils that gets mixed in and creates this rich organic matter. And so my aha moment, in short, to sum it up, was just to realize we have such a different climate. Let's work with it.
Right, right. Well, and what a great insight that Bob had, because that just kind of, to me, gives those of us on the West kind of permission to just recalibrate and reevaluate our whole palette of plants.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah. So you have a presentation for us today.
I do. Are we ready for it?
We are. We would love to have it.
Okay. So my presentation today is called What to Do to Keep Your Western Garden Beautiful All Year. And I thought it would be a nice way to tie up the series, since we're going to have these beautiful plants and they still are going to need some care. And I have primarily worked with the, I'm thinking about the next slide here. Let's go to the next slide, number two. So we've talked about dryland gardening from Bob Nold and other people in this series. And I just want to say that dryland plants and gardens do need a lot less maintenance because you're adding a lot less water. So when you add water, things grow, things you do want and things you don't want. And even the things that you do want, they grow more with more water. And usually things that grow more need to be controlled more or trimmed back more to keep them looking good. So more water basically equals more work. And I just want to share the experience I've had doing the work that I do, working with homeowners to create these gorgeous, super low-maintenance landscapes for them. And there is still always maintenance, especially with a new landscape, which is, I think, disheartening to a lot of homeowners. But when you plant new plants, they need water to get established. And watering the soil anytime is going to help any seeds in there germinate. And so they're watering a lot up front to get their plants established, and a lot of weeds are growing as a result. And so basically just add water means you get all kinds of plants, the good and the bad and the beautiful and the ugly, all of them. So maintenance is crucial for any landscape, and we need to remember that, and there's ways to make it easier on us by doing several things that we'll talk about as we go. And that's all just to put into context that what I want to talk about today is really the experience that I have had working for people throughout Southwest Colorado and helping them maintain their existing gardens. Most of the gardens I have maintained are not the ones that I have designed. For whatever reason, that's just how it's gone. So the plants I'll be talking about and the kind of gardens that I'll be talking about are the ones that I see most often. And so I'm hoping that it will be the most helpful to you all listening also, because these are common plants that people grow in the interior West. So I want to give kind of a seasonal breakdown of how to keep your garden beautiful and minimize maintenance throughout the year. And my neighbor, I have to tell you, it's really funny. My neighbor told me that before I moved in here next door to her, all of the neighbors, it was a really close-knit community. It still pretty much is, but different people. But she told me how beautiful everyone's gardens were and that she just did not have time for it or interest. So one year, she got sick of hearing about it from everyone. So one year, she went and bought silk plants, and she put them out like, yeah, it's good. She put them out in her backyard so that they could see from the street, like all this greenery and wonderful flowers, and they thought it was great. And then she said she forgot to bring them in the winter.
Oh, no.
And her secret was out. Everyone knew then. So I think it's pretty funny that she actually got away with that for any amount of time. But my point is just that there is no maintenance-free garden no matter what, unless you want to try that. But then you still have to bring them in the winter.
You still have to bring them in.
Yeah.
and remove them when they fade.
Yeah, from our intense sun.
Oh, that's great.
Exactly.
That's hilarious.
So we'll start here with late winter, kind of like I did with the series in general. And let's go to slide number 5 here. So I think of one of the garden tasks to be done in late winter as pruning. That's when almost all of the shrubs want to be pruned, woody shrubs. Mm. And not all of them need it every year. I have some clients who call me to do a consultation with them and walk me through their yard. And almost every single plant, they want to be doing something to it. And it's really hard for me to convince them that many of their shrubs really don't need them doing anything to them. They just kind of want to be left alone. And I think it's part of the Western aesthetic is to, and kind of a more modern take on gardening also from the meatball shrubs of the 70s and whatever. Now I think the trend is more to honor the plant and the shape of it naturally and to allow it to have its own natural, graceful form. And so that means we're not really doing as much shearing anymore. We're not taking the end 6 inches of the whole shrub all the way around off each year. That's just not necessary, especially when you heed the Master Gardener kind of motto, which is right plant for the right place. And so if you kind of want to make sure you plant your plants where they can stay their entire lives and mature and be happy and look good, and they aren't going to cover up this whole window that you want to be getting light through, if that's the case, plant something that doesn't get as big. And then you don't need to be working on it as much, and life is easier and everyone's happier. So let's go on to, let's go on to slide number 6, where there's a couple pictures of some really common cane shrubs. And what that refers to is they have canes growing out of the soil, the base, rather than, like, they all come from the crown, but instead of branching up even a little bit and then all of the branches coming out like a tree does, they all come out more or less from the ground. And
okay.
Yeah. So these kinds of shrubs generally like to be or respond well to being pruned each year using the one-third rule, which means removing one-third of the canes each year. So basically you're removing one-third of the whole plant each year. And if you look at that picture I have on the right-hand side is the dogwood. And you can look at that and realize what I'm saying. You've probably seen it and just not really thought about it, but you can learn to recognize the oldest canes by not only being the biggest, but also they're often fissured or on the redwood, the red twig dogwood, it's also browner. The fresher, newer stalks or canes are red. They're brighter, they're prettier, and they're also healthier. And so removing the biggest, oldest ones helps to force new healthy growth each year, which is better for the plant and its longevity, but it's also better for us because they look prettier, and that's what we have them for after all, right?
Yeah, and so this is where I've always got tangled up when I've been pruning my own shrubs is, you know, for example, when I see a cane that is clearly one of the older ones, am I supposed to take that one down a third, or do I just take that one out? And then the new ones, I always feel bad cutting those back, but I go ahead and take a third anyway because I've been told to. So is it a third all around, or, you know, some of those older ones, even if they're still alive, you keep them going? Because obviously sometimes there are some that are just dead and need to be removed.
Right.
But, so is there a difference between how you handle the older but not dead canes versus the clearly younger ones?
There is a difference, and thanks for clarifying that. Yes, the difference is the old ones get totally removed, and the young, new, healthy ones don't get touched.
So the old ones, even if they're still alive?
Yeah, and they probably will be.
Remove them.
Yeah, I assume that they will
be
still alive.
Mm,
and so you want to get in there as far down to the base as possible. You don't want to be leaving any stubs or even like 3 inches, 6 inches, 2 inches, much less, you know, 24 inches. Anytime you do that, it's going to look kind of like a blunt cut that's going to show up. It's going to look a little hacked or maybe a lot hacked. And it's not really honoring that graceful architecture that the shrub naturally has. So that's what we're going for.
That is so helpful. And when you cut that back, does it matter the angle of the cutting surface or the cut surface, I should say?
Yeah, actually, that's a good question, too. Generally, you want to cut at about a 45-degree angle anytime you're pruning pretty much anything. And it matters a little less or maybe even a lot less here in the arid west or semi-arid than it did where I learned how to prune in coastal California because it's so wet there. You want to do everything you can to get moisture to drain off. So that 45-degree angle helps to water not to just, or any kind of moisture, to not just sit there, which can cause different fungal problems on a fresh cut. And but in keeping with that, you really don't want to go out on a rainy, misty, or snowy sort of day. You want it to be a sunny, dry day when you do it.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, not to belabor a point, but I have one more question because I know you have a lot of slides. With that angled cut, does it matter if that faces up to the sun or faces down to the ground or just as long as it's 45 degrees?
Well, I mean, it's still going to be facing up, assuming the cane is headed upwards, which usually they are. I mean, probably ideally is sloping down away from the plant rather than sloping in toward the center of the plant. But it's getting pretty nitty-gritty and may not matter that much. With roses, it might matter more because they seem to be more pest and disease prone anyway. And that's a whole kind of art unto itself.
Okay. All right.
Yeah, with a 45-degree angle, you should be really good.
Okay, great.
Yeah, and speaking of if it's facing up or down, anytime there is a branch laying on the ground, unless it's like a sort of creeping shrub like Grollo sumac or one of the Prunus bessiae like Pawnee buttes or one of those creeping ground cherries, unless it's a creeping sort of shrub, if it's an upright shrub and there happens to be an unruly branch or cane that is laying on the ground, that would be a good one usually to cut out because they can pick up some diseases also from that excess moisture they aren't meant to be subjected to for an ongoing basis when they're laying on the ground. So if you're wanting to clean up and keep your garden tidy and everything looking good and going the right direction, that's a good one to remove. And before I leave slide number 6, I'll just say, too, the forsythia on the left, I'm sure someone out there is thinking, yeah, but if you cut that in the late winter, you're cutting off this year's flower buds. And, yes, that's true. You are, because it blooms on last year's wood. But the thing is, if you're keeping it healthy by removing one-third of the canes, they're not going to be there anyway, so it's not going to matter. It's not like shaping a lilac and removing its blooms, and then that's all you get this year. You know, forsythia bloom all up and down the whole stalk throughout the whole plant, the whole cane.
Okay.
So, yeah, that I don't think of that as a something to be concerned about. I think the health of the plant overall is important. But if you do it early, like late winter and not springtime, then you're less likely to knock off those buds on the existing or the remaining canes that you leave there, because you don't want to do that.
Right.
Then it will affect how many flowers you end up with.
Right.
So let's go ahead and go to slide number 7. And I have a picture there of my kind of old Felco pruners. These are just hand pruners. And this is a really important point with maintenance. Use good tools. Your job will be so much easier. You'll be happier. You'll be happier with the results because sharp cuts are healthier for plants. If you have a jagged cut, it's going to be easier for moisture to get in there and stay in there longer than it should, or for diseases to start. And if you have a nice clean cut, you're just going to keep everything healthier and in better shape. So use good tools. Bypass pruners are what you're looking at here, and that means the blades actually pass each other to close. You can see the upper skinny blade has that silver edge, and that part overlaps with the blade, the lower part, which is actually the blade part. It just pushes against that top, skinnier part. But because they pass by each other, it can make a much cleaner cut than the other kind of pruners, which are often cheaper. And so a lot of people buy them as kind of entry-level pruners, and they're called anvil pruners. And that's where the blade comes down on a flat surface and smushes whatever you're trying to cut. And they work fine for a little while, but as soon as they get dull at all, you're just smushing the cells and the branch or the stem or whatever you're trying to cut, and you don't get a clean cut. Instead, you're really just injuring the plant. So this is important, and if you fork out a little more money at the beginning, you'll be much happier in the end for all kinds of reasons. Felcos, I really like. They're kind of a higher end, but all these parts you see, you can totally take this apart, and that spring in there and the two handles, everything comes apart. Those rubber, the red coverings on the handles are replaceable. Everything's replaceable and cleanable, and so that makes it nice. You can have a pair pretty much forever. And Baco, I believe is the name. I think it's B-A-C-O. HCO is a brand that a good friend of mine uses and swears by, and I need to test those out still, but that might be a kind you're looking for. Probably better luck with those online than at a local place, but wanting to support our local nurseries, you can find these Felcos or Corona. A lot of people like Coronas also. And sterilizing them periodically is a great idea, especially if you're pruning something that is more susceptible to problems like roses. People in like rose production, for example, or I know for sure for fruit tree production, they carry a little thing on their belt with bleach, and they'll dip those pruners in the bleach between every single cut they make. Now, like I said, that's production. So I don't do that. I don't recommend doing that unless you really, really want to. But in between plants, I think it makes great sense. In between two different roses when you're pruning them or going from a fruit tree or any tree to a different plant. You know, I think it's just a good practice. And carrying around any kind of liquid bleach I don't think is real wise. I actually like using Clorox wipes or any of those sanitizing disinfectant wipes that are just meant for cleaning your hands kind of thing when you're camping or whatever.
Right.
Yeah, I like carrying.
Well, that sounds much easier.
Yeah, I just stash those in my gardening bag and away I go. So.
Right.
Yeah.
Excellent.
And then, let's see. There we go. Okay, so slide number 8, we have a picture of blue mist spirea is what the common name is that it most often goes by, but I've tended to drop the spirea because it's just so confusing. It's not a spirea. It is a whole different genus of plant, and so I call it blue mist, so people hopefully still know what I'm talking about. But and I call it by its common name, which its botanical name, which I'm totally spacing right now. So I'll remember probably midway through and I'll tell you. But anyway, also like this blue mist is chamisa, which is also called Chrysophamnus nauseosa or rabbit brush. There's a whole bunch of different plants, but these are some of the ones I see most commonly that respond well to having what's called rejuvenation pruning. And that's where you go in and you actually cut them all the way to the base of the plant. Like we're talking pretty much soil level or an inch or two above. And like this one we're looking at on slide number 8, I don't think this needs it. It's just that I was showing you what plant it is in its winter form with those seed heads. When they get real leggy or they're old or no one's done anything to them in years, sometimes the form is not so nice and there's not much you can do to help them out. Shearing them often doesn't get you very far. So rejuvenation pruning can be really the best approach. And you can do this also with dogwoods or forsythia. And it's really just a dramatic pruning, and you want to do it while they are dormant. So like the one you see in this picture, at that time of year, late winter, early spring, before they start putting new growth on. You can do that with Potentilla, take your pick. And, a lot of shrubs. There's more information online about it, too, if you are so inclined.
Okay. Was Caryopteris the word you were looking for?
Yay! Thanks, Sarah.
You're welcome.
Yes, I like to call them Caryopteris, but because I got my startings with botany, I generally prefer botanical names whenever I can, but I feel like I can't get away with that talking with clients a lot of the time because they aren't comfortable with it and don't know what I'm talking about, and my whole intent is to communicate. So. But I do encourage people to learn botanical names anytime because they make a lot of sense once you get it down.
So
sure. Slide number 9, we have Russian sage, and the one on the left is in its winter form. That's pretty much what they look like here right now. I saw a few shoots coming out on my plant just the other day, but not much. And on the right side is what they look like in summer. You'll probably recognize that. They're a very common plant to grow around here in the interior west. And my personal opinion is they are way overused. I never put them in my own designs unless the client begs me.
Okay.
And if they are getting much moisture, they reseed. And like this on the right, you can just see maybe that's attractive. It's arguably attractive, but it's just kind of boring. There's just so many of them, and they sprout up everywhere. And when they get too much moisture, they'll often splay out in the middle, as do catmint. If the soil is too rich or too moist, they just overgrow themselves is basically what's happening, and they don't look good. So they really are good for our lean and mean soils. But you gotta temper them with other more interesting plants, in my opinion. But they're in here. The whole reason I put them in here was not to go on a tirade, actually, but to tell you that now is the time to prune them, late winter, early spring. And you want to cut them about 6 inches from the ground. And basically what that's doing is leaving 3 to 4 bud pairs. And as soon as you look down in there, you'll know what I mean. The buds grow opposite from each other on the stem, and you want to cut just above one of those pairs, leaving 3 to 4 of the pairs on there. And then they'll get their healthiest start back up for the season, and they'll have a better, more compact form and flower better and look better. And slide number 10, Buddleia Davidiae and Buddleia alternifolia are two different plants. We only have the picture of the alternifolia here, which is called silver butterfly bush. And that one's different. I'll get back to that in just a second. But the Buddleia Davidiae, which is more commonly grown, actually is treated pretty similar to the Russian sage. It's pruned at this time of year, every year, and severely. You want to cut that back to about 1 foot from the ground. It's a much larger shrub. I didn't say that. Russian sage is technically considered a sub-shrub, so that's why it gets a different treatment than a lot of these other shrubs. But the butterfly bush, Buddleia Davidiae, or it should actually be pronounced David-E-I. The whole point I've learned is that you want to keep the integrity with the person's name, if it's named after a person, which many plants are, you want to keep the integrity of that name. And so
so that overrules the Latin.
Yep. So instead of Jonesii, for example, it should be pronounced Jones-E-I. Jones-E-I. So
David-E-I.
Yeah. So anyway, I divulge once again. But this plant, the regular butterfly bush, needs to be cut back every single year about 1 foot from the base to have the healthiest growth structure and nicest looking form. This plant that I have the picture of, the Buddleia alternifolia, I actually like a lot better. I think it's so unique and pretty. It does need a little more water, though, than the other one. But it does not need to be pruned back every year like the other one. This plant you see here, still on slide 10, is at my neighbor's house. And so I've been seeing it for 7 years now. And they not once have they given it any severe pruning. They kind of prune it more moderately. Now and then they'll remove a branch that's hanging down too low as it gets taller. But it's beautiful. And a funny side note is they told me that they bought it in a 2-inch pot from some plant sale somewhere, and it was marked tarragon. They don't always get what
and surprise.
Yeah, exactly.
Did they put it on their fish?
On their what?
They did. On their fish. I hope they didn't cook with it.
Yeah, I hope not too. I don't know. They didn't tell me that part. Okay.
Funny.
So now we're going to go on to trees. And I'm just going to touch briefly on trees by saying that it's important to hire a good certified arborist for most tree issues, especially your larger trees. I really have come to believe that a certified arborist is the way to go for tree issues because I've just seen so many trees topped and hacked and abused, really, by people who claim to know what they're doing but don't know what they're doing. And the smaller trees, though, like the one in this picture on number 11, is, you know, it's a flowering, ornamental, smaller tree. And a lot of those we can do our own pruning on safely from the ground. And with those bypass pruners, like I showed you in a previous slide, those are really good for pencil width, pencil diameter, and smaller. And larger than that, to get a clean, good cut, you want to use loppers, which are the long-handled pruners. And those can cut tree branches up to 1 inch in diameter. And after that, you want to look at a pruning saw just for the best clean cut, but also for ease of maintenance. And so what we are looking at for trees here on slide 12 is dead, diseased, damaged, and crossing branches should be removed. Those can be removed any time of the year. What you want to do at this time of year is any serious, or not this time, sorry, a little bit earlier than now, when the tree is still dormant. So it can be late fall, early winter, or it can be late winter, but while it's dormant for sure is when you want to do the structural pruning. Like if you have moved into a house or just are taking notice of a tree that hasn't been cared for, pruned properly for years, and it needs some real structural pruning to get rid of all kinds of branches that are growing in toward the center of the plant or they're crossing a lot. Those things, they actually say you can cut up to 1/3 of the mass of the tree by removing those things.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and so that's some serious structural pruning, and that needs to be done when the tree is dormant. But at any time of the year, you can and should remove dead, diseased, and damaged branches because, again, for the health of the plant, that's important. And slide 13 here, it's a little bit hard to see in this picture, but this, you can see the left side of this tree has some new leaves forming on it. The right side is totally dead. But that's not the best example because it's kind of beyond, it might be beyond hope. Also, it's a Siberian elm, which is a weed. It's just a big weed. They break easily in storms. They grow super fast, and they seed everywhere. So that is just to demonstrate dead, disease, damaged, and crossing is something to get used to looking for and removing at the right time of the year, which is any time except for the crossing.
Okay.
It's alive.
Okay, great.
Yeah. And so I know it's really hard for a lot of people, it seems like, to wait until late winter to prune your ornamental grasses. But please learn to do this. Apply that restraint and do not cut your ornamental grasses back in the fall when you're doing all of your other perennial cutting back. So this picture here on slide 14 is what a grass should look like about now. It was cut back to about the right amount. Usually for a larger grass like this, maybe 6 inches from the ground, just flat top is fine. And that allows this new growth coming up to come up gracefully and to eventually hide last year's growth that you've cut back. Whereas if you didn't cut it at all, it would just look like a big mess. And the point of, well, I don't know about the point, but from a design standpoint, a big reason we like to use ornamental grasses in the landscape is for their winter beauty and their drama and their grace and their movement. There's so little that moves and blows in the wind in the winter. But ornamental grasses do until or unless they get pummeled by snow. But some years they do, some years they don't. And so it's nice to have them there when little else is and not cut them back until late winter, just before the new growth starts. That's the goal.
Mm. And is that how you qualify late winter? Because, of course, especially here in Colorado, you know, of course, there's winter on the calendar, but there's winter by the weather. And where you live, your snowfall is way different than my snowfall here on the eastern front of the Rockies. So how do we go about figuring out, okay, I'm now in late winter versus early spring?
That's a really good question. And the answer really is just to be aware and notice what's going on. If there's still snow on the ground, like a lot of it, and it's March, I'd still consider that winter for this purpose, even if it's late March. You're not going to dig a hole through the snow to prune your grass. But like a year like we've had here, and I think from what I've heard, most of the West has had, late winter was in March and the snow was gone. And so basically you just use nature as your cue. When the snow is gone and you can access it, and before the new growth starts.
So keep an eye on your plants.
Keep an eye on your plants.
It's what it sounds like. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, thanks,
great.
Okay. So slide number 15, I want to talk to you about junipers. I know a lot of people seem to love to hate junipers, and I think they get a bad rap because humans put them in the wrong places. It's sort of like people leave their garbage out and the bears get into it, and then they're mad at the bear. We have problems like that here all the time. So junipers can be a beautiful plant and really low maintenance and really well adapted if they're used properly and given enough room. More often than any other problem, I just see them not given enough room. They're large plants, and this I'm talking about the ground cover juniper here. And they can take, I mean, one of the great things about them is they can fill in a huge amount of space, and so you get a lot of bang for your buck with junipers. And this is a landscape that I have maintained for a number of years, and I think they actually did a really nice job, whoever designed it and planted these different kinds of junipers here. It makes it interesting but super low maintenance. Usually the only thing I have to do is keep the junipers from eating the curb, because I know what happens then. They get just beat up, or someone comes by and hacks a straight line in them, which is the real problem with maintaining junipers. You do not want to just cut a straight line of everything that's hanging over the sidewalk or the curb or whatever it is. So if you look closely at these two pictures, you might notice that the one on the left is the before picture and the one on the right is the after picture. So what the goal is these little feathery shoots that are coming out on the one on the left beyond where they should be, I kind of grab that in my hand, and with the other hand, with gloves on, I follow it back into the depths of the shrub as far as I can get, and that's where I cut it. And I do that with each one individually until it looks like the picture on the right. And then it leaves a natural-looking shrub. You can't – I mean, I did that with the grayer one that's higher up in the picture too, and that one is a little less apparent just because of the way the shrub is growing, I think. But it's you shouldn't really notice that it just got pruned is the goal.
Mm-hmm.
It should still maintain its natural form and integrity. So,
mm-hmm.
yeah, that's junipers. Oh, and Cotone asters. Looks like cotton Easter, but it is pronounced Cotone aster. If you look at it, it really has a very similar growth habit as a ground cover juniper. It's kind of arching and sprawling, and mm-hmm. it looks awful if you hack it in the wrong place. And so you want to do basically the same thing with those, or go back to where the branch, the offending branch, meets the larger branch, and you cut it right there so it's in line with the remaining larger branch and maintains its graceful form.
Right.
So let's move on to spring. And this is a picture of a native cassulea, which is also the paintbrush a couple Marianne talked about last week, and Bill Adams also talked about being difficult to grow, but you can grow them with certain associations. This one's wild, so I think it's beautiful. Bulbs, let's talk about bulbs real quick. So I know it's hard to restrain yourself, but you really do... You really do need to leave the leaves of your bulbs there, growing attached, until they are not green anymore. When they're more brown than they are green, then it's time to remove them. But until then, they are making food from the sun. They're making chlorophyll. They're storing it in that bulb that gives you such beautiful flowers next year. So... It just needs to be that way. Some people want to braid the leaves of their daffodils. Well, that's really not recommended. It's not so good. It can cause some rot problems and, again, diseases. And it doesn't help them to collect the sun's energy. One thing that you can do is plant perennials around the bulbs that will get big enough early enough to obscure the leaves of some of those bulbs once the flowering is done with the bulbs. So that can be a good trick.
And are you going to share some of those perennials that would bloom early enough?
Nope. No, I mean, that's just not what I'm focusing on right now, but
sure.
Our summer segment of the series talked about all kinds of amazing, beautiful plants, and I know Pat Hayward divided her talk up by season, and there were a whole slew of spring blooming plants, and those would be a good palette to choose from for this purpose.
Fantastic. And I had heard regarding bulb leaves that if you give a gentle tug and it comes out easily, that it was ready to come out. Is that a myth?
I don't think so. I mean, what I have found is that when they are still more green than brown and I give them a gentle tug, they don't come out. So I don't think
they're not coming out anyway.
Contradictory. Mm-hmm. I think it's in line with this. So, yeah.
Okay. Okay,
yeah.
Great.
And I do like to, I'll get to that a little further on too. I do like to use that method of removal whenever possible, is to give a gentle tug, and when it comes out, then it just makes, I feel like it's working with the plant better somehow. I can't really put my finger on, but it also is more aesthetic because then it comes off at the base, sometimes from the crown of the plant directly, which is usually be low soil level, and you don't see this stubby, hacked off looking thing remaining that's the base of the leaf. So here's just a little flash for you of some bulbs on slide number 18. These are all from my garden. The left is a, I think the variety name is lilac wonder, I want to say. But in any case, this is a species tulip or wildflower tulip. It's kind of a dwarf compared to the hybrids that most people know, with the egg-shaped and sized blooms that are tall that the deer love. Those are usually referred to as Darwin hybrids. And actually, these two pictures on the left, the center and the left, are both species tulips, and the deer don't like them nearly as much, and I think they're way more interesting. And then there's my daffies on the right. And then...
Gotta have daffies.
Yeah. Actually, they came with the property. I didn't plant them. I like the more unusual things myself. But so slide number 19, we're going to get to this a little bit more in detail with the fall section. But this is basically why not to leave the stubs in the fall, because in the spring, this is what you get. And all that nice new growth would look so much fresher and prettier if it was unmarred by all those brown stalks, and they aren't doing anybody any good.
Yeah. What was this plant?
That's a, pretty sure that's a Shasta daisy. I walked past
it okay.
in my neighborhood. Yeah, I bet dollars to donuts it's a Shasta daisy.
Okay.
It's a little hard to tell at that stage, though.
Right.
So then slide number 20, and I better get speeding up here because I'm kind of, well, I better get speeding up. So I'll do that. And this is slide 20. I'm just mentioning the idea of green or living mulch as my introduction to mulch in general. This is pretty much all different forms of thyme, and I just thought it was so pretty. And so the idea of mulch is to cover the soil, to keep it moister, and to keep weeds from being able to come up. And you can do that with plant material, or if you go to slide number 21, you can, that's the next slide. Or you can use other materials we'll talk about in a moment. But the whole purpose of mulch, other than green mulch, like in slide 20, the purpose of mulch is not to be a focal point. The point of it is to create a finished look and to serve its function, as I just said. And larger chunks that I often see people get because they just don't know what they're supposed to get really don't help do this. So there's like usually it's called large nugget pine bark mulch. I think that's the one I see most often. That's just way too big to do the job at all. It's purely decorative at that point. And then the other note about mulch I want to make is that mulch volcanoes are a no-no. So that's what we call it when you push all the mulch up against the base of the plant. And you want to do just the opposite. You actually want to slope the mulch down to the base of the plant, not actually touching any part of the plant itself. And so by doing that, you're keeping the stem or trunk or whatever it is, this applies to all plants, you're keeping them much more, you're keeping them drier, because having that mulch right up against the stem will hold in moisture in the above air parts. The above ground parts that are meant to get lots of air and be dry and not to keep moisture in. So no mulch for volcano.
Okay, great.
And then slide 22 is just a quick breakdown of wood or bark mulch versus gravel. So wood people tend to like because it looks lusher and more woodsy. And it's brown, sometimes that reddish color like the cedar. And it also sucks up moisture. I don't know if you've had this experience, but when it rains sometimes, it might seem like a hard rain. And I'll think, oh, good time to go out in my garden and pull a few weeds. And I move the mulch out of the way, and that soil is bone dry. The mulch sucked up the entire amount of water that just came down. And so when you're watering your garden, if you water by hand or overhead, you have to keep the same thing in mind. You want that moisture to get down to the root zone, and gravel allows that to happen better. So if you're planting a dryland garden, gravel is a much better bet because it allows the moisture, any moisture that comes, to percolate down to the actual soil. It also allows for plants to be able to reseed better. And if that's a desirable trait for you. But then also, by the same token, weed seeds that blow around and land can also reseed better, too. Finer particles of wood mulch are definitely better for the reasons we already talked about. And a depth of at least 3 to 4 inches is really desirable to do the job. Otherwise, again, it's just decorative. And let's see. So things that you want to avoid is dyed mulch, because it looks totally unnatural. I know sometimes people are inclined to buy a dyed mulch that matches their house, but again, that's not really the function of mulch. It is to serve a function, not to stand out. And cocoa mulch is something, a product that came out a few years back, and there were reports of dogs eating it and getting sick and even dying. So sounds like a good idea, probably not so good in reality.
Not so good, yeah.
Yeah, pistachio mulch was another one like that. I mean, it makes great sense to make use of products that have no other use. But the pistachio mulch, I heard it blew away pretty readily, and squirrels took off with it.
And then, it is not.
Yeah, exactly. And then for slopes and windy areas, if you want a wood or bulk mulch, I really recommend the cedar mulch. Western cedar is a really common kind to find around these parts because it knits together better and holds in place a lot better. And it's a nice, pretty reddish color. The downside is, well, up and down, it is finer particles, and so it breaks down much more quickly. So it feeds the soil by doing that with organic matter. So if you're looking for that, then it can be a plus. But then you also have to replace it more readily, usually in springtime, because the snow on it all winter really helps or contributes to breaking it down.
Huh.
Slide 24 is a picture of some gnarled weed mat. I have not worked with any client or heard from any person who's had a landscape for very long at all, like more than a few years, that is happy with weed mat. I don't think it functions the way that they say that it should, where it lets nutrients and nutrients come up through it or come down from the rain. Moisture doesn't penetrate it very well. Weeds still grow under it and compete for those nutrients with your plants. Anytime you have to pull it up, you'll see them there. Weeds that land on top of it still manage to get their roots down into it, and then to weed them out is much harder, actually, and you actually usually end up making a hole in it, which kind of defeats the purpose. As your plants grow larger, you often need to cut around it more to allow that expansion. There's no chance of reseeding if that's something you like, if you want a garden that can kind of evolve and migrate and spreaders be allowed to spread, forget it, with weed mat. Also, it doesn't last forever. Like this picture shows, if it has to be replaced and you have a mature landscape, that's a huge project. Otherwise, what usually happens is you're just ripping out chunks of it at a time, like in this picture. And that's what I've done for a ton of maintenance clients I've worked for over the years. 25 is just, I couldn't really resist throwing this picture in, avoid xeriscapes. So many people mispronounce the word xeriscape. the X-E-R-I-scape, which means dry, mm-hmm. and they say zero-scapes, and it just perpetuates a misconception about what that is. Their scape can be beautiful and lush and a really fulfilling, colorful garden. It is not what you see in this picture, slide 25. This is a zero-scape. This is a plastic mat that's been laid down over the landscape. Slide 26, summer. This is our Wiminuche Mountains wilderness area here in the San Juans. And this is Old Man of the Mountain, Hymenoxus, now called Tetranurus, a really great wildflower I just love.
Gorgeous.
Yeah.
Really gorgeous.
Okay, so slide 27, perennials. Let's see, there's something. Oh, this is what I was going to say. So there's a T-shirt that I've seen online that says, "Friends don't let friends plant annuals." I think it's really funny. And as far as low-maintenance landscapes go, it makes sense. We want perennials because they come back year after year on their own. So that's, you can assume in this whole presentation today, I'm not talking about any annuals. If they're flowers, they're perennials. So mm-hmm. The kind of perennials I like to grow are the kind that need attention just one time each year. Like I talked about those ornamental grasses, they need to be cut mm-hmm. back late winter, early spring each year. That's it. Otherwise, you really don't do anything to them. Some of my favorites mm-hmm. are Mirabilis multiflora, which is Desert 4 o'clock, Enocera mm-hmm. macrocarpa, which is the evening primrose, the ones with the huge yellow flowers, and then they turn into these really big seed pods that look a lot like star fruit, if you've ever seen star fruit mm-hmm. at the store. So they're really decorative, too. Digitalis obscura, Pat Hayward talked about. It's an evergreen annual, or I mean perennial, I'm sorry. There's a picture of it coming up. Echium, there's a picture of that coming up, too. That's red feathers is its common name. Those are both plant select plants, as well as Erodium crescentia is.
Mm-hmm.
And, oh, that common name, shoot. I'm not remembering that common name right now. Anyway, go to the Plant Select site and you'll find it. Areogonum umbellatum and ornamental grasses. Areogonum is the buckwheat, the sulfur buckwheat with the yellow flowers. And these are all great plants that I use in my landscape designs because people want very low maintenance. And I think most, if not all of these, are also deer resistant and hardy to, let's see, zone 4, definitely zone 5, maybe zone 4. Okay, slide 28, Dallosperma, which is ice plant growing in my garden. I forget if this is John Prophet or Red Mountain. I think it's John Prophet, but it's just gorgeous. You don't deadhead it or cut it back. Nothing is super low or even no maintenance plant. On the right, up high, you can see those little white flowers. That's the erodium. I'm not sure if that's crescentia or not, but it looks very much like that. And then slide 29, in the very back on the left, the orange is the Digitalis obscura, the mm-hmm. Foxglove, the Plant Select Foxglove. In front of that to the right is the Echium red feathers. In the foreground is a different variety of Erodium that I really love. I think it looks like little viola flowers. That's available at the nurseries, too. So slide number 30, I just want to call these fakers out. these plants get called low maintenance, and I guess they could be, well, I just figured, I just thought of another one that should be added to this list, which is daylilies. They're all plants that tend to be deer resistant, and they grow pretty well or really well in our soils. And so in that way, they are low maintenance. But the reason I don't love them is, like the daylily, the leaves are always turning yellow or brown at all different times, and there's so many leaves, and you're having to pull them out or cut them out one at a time almost to make it keep looking good through the season. And that's after it's flowered and you've cut back the flower stalk. So it's just multiple visits to the plant throughout the year, which I think is too much. And they just look messy otherwise. Nepeta is catmint. We're on slide 30. I don't know if I said that. Catmint, it's okay. Like I said, it can flop open if it has the wrong set of circumstances, like too much love. We talked last week about water not equaling love, and this is a case in point. But if you shear it back once or twice a year, once the flowers are spent, it will rebloom. So these are ones that people like because you can extend the blooming season, and that is nice. There's something to be said about that. But like I said, for me, it's just more than I want to do. The Mainite Salvia and the Centrantis, which is Jupiter's beard, are also really common garden plants around here. But to keep them flowering and looking good, you're having to go in there every few days and or maybe once a week and deadhead them. And the trick with these is to cut them back to the next bud lower that has not yet bloomed or is in bloom to keep them looking good. And they will keep blooming for a long period of time. And I guess that's the thing that's helped keep my maintenance business in business for a number of years. So.
You're not complaining about that part.
What's that, Sarah?
You're not complaining about that part.
Yeah, I guess not. And then Shasta Daisy, it looks like it would be one of these. It looks like you should be able to cut back the spent flower to the next lowest bud. But in my experience, they have not rebloomed. In all different properties all around where I've done this, they won't rebloom. So I heard one person said they got them to rebloom, but I don't know how. So it's kind of a faker in its own way, too. slide 31, design tip for easier maintenance, plant in masses. This is actually a picture from one of my Crested Butte wildflower walks that I've done. And so mimic nature. Nature plants with wide, big brush strokes, and it's so dynamic when that's done. All these fields of purple are just incredible. And then if in your landscape you plant large groupings of plants together, you go in and you just get in autopilot and you know exactly what to do with all of those plants in that whole area because it's the same thing. And so it makes for a more dramatic show, it looks more natural, and it's easier to maintain.
Yeah.
Slide 32, I love shrubs. They make a great choice for planting. Shrubs are the same thing as bushes, and they are not just the boring, I mean, in your opinion, maybe boring junipers. Hopefully you'll give those another chance, too. But I think that's how a lot of people think of shrubs, as these hedges or these evergreen plants that just are not real stimulating to look at. But there's so many different ones that need nothing from us year after year. Grolow sumac is one of my favorites recently. Apache plume is another native that needs little to nothing from us, and those are both very drought tolerant. There's just a whole slew of them, so take another look. The Pawnee Butte sand cherry I mentioned earlier on is a good one. There's a bunch of them, and they do almost all of them do flower, the deciduous ones. They can be very decorative and ornate throughout the season. They can have amazing fall color, and they can take up a lot of real estate with just one planting of one plant. If you are looking for that, if you have a large property and you don't want to plant a bunch of 1 gallon or smaller perennials, they can make a lot of sense. Let's move on to fall on slide 33. And this picture was very intentional. It was a very red Quercus gambellii, Gamble's oak, which is also referred to as scrub oak, which I think does not honor it enough. But I like using its proper name, Gamble's oak, because I think it's a great plant. And I just want to tell everyone that if you can learn to love this plant, you're going to be so much further ahead in your maintenance regime, because I have met with many people who want this whole hillside or area of their yard to not have any of the oak in it that's naturally growing there. They want to plant something else, which I know they will then struggle to get going and get enough water to get established and all this stuff. And oaks naturally are very well established and want to just be there and do their thing. And I think they're really cool. And they're one that can deal very well with the rejuvenation pruning, because they were they're basically adapted to that through fire. If they burn all the way to the ground, they come up really fast and more healthy and fuller and better shape. So if you have some old ones you don't like the shape of, you can always try that. And if you lose a couple of them and that's what you want, then you're further ahead, I guess. But probably they'll just come back even more. So that's what I see people go through who think they don't want those oaks, is they cut them, they rent a huge machine to just cut them all to the ground, and then they come back even stronger and fuller and, in my opinion, more beautiful. So learn to love them. You'll be further ahead. Okay, slide 34, when to cut back perennials. The fall is really an ideal time. The reason is that then in the spring, you don't have to be worrying about cutting things back then. You can just let the green, nice, new, fresh, tender growth come up and enjoy it without all that brown that we'll see again in a second if you leave those tubs. The exception is that some plants like Echinacea or Rudbeckia, which is brown-eyed Susan, have decorative seed heads. And Autumn Joy Sedum is another nice one that can look really pretty long after they're done blooming, and humans and birds can enjoy those seed heads for a long time to come. So a lot of people like to leave those until the springtime and cut those then. I think that the best rule of thumb is if it looks ugly to you because it turned all brown, cut it. If you still think it looks pretty for whatever reason, leave it, but make sure to cut it early in the spring, because what can happen, we're blessed with very few insect pests here in the interior west, but what can happen is that the insects can lay their eggs on the old year's, last year's growth, and then in the spring, those insects have evolved to hatch exactly at the right time for that tender new growth, and then they'll attack it. And you really don't want that to happen. So that's one reason, besides aesthetics, to be on top of removing the old spent growth. Okay, slide 35, no stubs, remember. They don't
Getting close.
Yes, they don't do anybody any good. Just take them all the way down to the ground in the fall, and then at this time of year, you don't have to worry about going back in there and trying to get them out and not cut the new growth, and then, you know, that increases your visits to the plant. Just one time when you cut it back during the year, take it all the way to the base. Then these are plants that can be be cleaned up just by a gentle tugging. Like we talked about earlier, okay. Iris leaves the erodium, armaria, which is sea thrift, allium, which is the ornamental onion bulb, some hemerocallis, which is the daylily, some species of that or varieties, I find the flower stalks will nicely remove by a gentle tug, and it just feels a little easier. You don't have to worry about accidentally clipping one of the leaves. And then Mirabilis multiflora, the desert 4 o'clock, Oenothera macrocarpa, those are both really interesting because it's like the whole plant it's like an eject button gets hit. And if you wait long enough into the fall, the whole plant detaches from the crown. And then you can just pick them up. You don't have to cut or pull or anything. It's kind of amazing.
Great.
People always want to fertilize. I use very little fertilizer myself. But if you really are going to feel better by doing something like that, I recommend a product called Yum Yum Mix, which is more of a soil conditioner. I don't think it even says fertilizer on it, but it does have a ratio, the NPK ratio, but it's very, very low. More, it helps to break up clay soils and condition the soil for plants that like that situation better. It makes it easier for them, and doing that both fall and spring, just kind of moving your mulch aside and putting it on the soil surface, kind of scratching it in, and then removing the mulch is all you have to do. And then okay. I wanted to mention tree wraps real quick. They are very useful in this climate for our intense winter sun, and they prevent sun scald or southwest damage, I've heard it called, on young trees. Once they get bigger than your arm, they really don't need it anymore. But everyone's seen trees that are just cracked and the trunk or the bark is gone and it looks like a wound, and sometimes it gets into the heartwood and that will be cracked, and they're not long for this world. And when you notice trees like that, notice what direction they're facing, and it usually is southwest, and it happens during the winter, and it can be prevented by using tree wraps. I like the white coil ones that you just kind of roll onto the trunk of your tree. The white reflects the sun's heat, and they're easy to use. But make sure to remove them in the spring. Earwigs like to get in there, and again, it holds in moisture, and it makes it dark where it's meant to be light and airy, and you want to keep your plant healthy, so make sure to remove them in the spring.
Okay.
So people always ask me when you can plant. You can really plant anytime you can dig a hole, meaning when the ground isn't frozen, it's fine with perennials or woody plants. The annuals are the only ones that it matters, that you want to wait till after frost date. Early spring and fall are ideal because there's less transplant shock that plants can get from the intense sunlight. And there's two schools of thought as to which one is better, and there's a reason for each of them, but I think you're good with either one. Summer works too, if that's when it has to happen, but you just have to be more on top of tending to your plants and make sure you can water them. So if you're going out of town for a period during the summer, I wouldn't plant then. You just can't monitor them as well that way. Or you could hire a crew or a company or whatever to keep on top of it. Slide 40,
okay.
Good news. This is a catmint. I think it's the only picture I have in here of it. This is actually from my garden. The catmint volunteered itself in a really difficult position that's like 2 inches wide on the side of my sidewalk, and I decided if it could make it there, it was allowed to stay. And there's right next to my hens and chicks. But the point I want to make here is that it's growing with rocks, and the good news is that plants like rocks. They actually do better with rocks around. I know we have some really rocky soils around here, and it's still hard to dig in, but you don't have to remove all of those rocks or any of them for the plant's sake. So that's good. And then I just wanted to show you my picture of my little hens and chicks, my Semper Vivums. they're just easy and fun. And that's my whole presentation. So thank you so much, everyone, for listening, and I hope you learned a lot about how to maintain your yard with and garden with little as little maintenance as possible.